This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. It is, as always, we will be talking, by the way, a little later on in the program with the president of the Writers Guild. Get the whole inside scoop on the Writers Guild strike. But, of course, it's the day after the caucus in Iowa. And Friday, as always, our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Senator Sanders, his website, sanders.senate.gov. He's got a great newsletter. I got a copy of it a couple days ago that he sends out about, you know, what's going on in the Senate, what's going on in the country. And the independent senator from Vermont. And he will be taking your calls, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States. In just a few minutes, if you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com, click chat up at the top of the page. There's also a blog there and a blog over at airamerica.com. So all that said, Senator Sanders, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you, Bernie. Great to have you here. Your thoughts on last night's primaries?
Well, I'll tell you what caucuses. I was very, very excited about is the huge turnout that took place on the Democratic side.
Yeah.
You'll remember that 4 years ago there was a very hotly contested caucus there. That's when Kerry won.
Mm-hmm.
They put a lot of money into it and a lot of energy into it, and this time you have seen almost a doubling of the number of people who came out on the Democratic caucus, and far, far more than it came out on the Republican side, despite all of the money that Romney spent and the efforts of Huckabee's people. So I think what that tells me is this is the first moment that people had the opportunity to cast a ballot in opposition to the disastrous policies of George W. Bush, and they came out in droves.
Yeah.
And I think if we can keep that effort going all over this country, come Election Day, there will be a major victory against the policies of the worst president in the history of our country.
Yeah, and if I may add to that, I would say it's not just George W. Bush, because what we're looking at is the culmination of 26 years since Reagan came into office of conservative economic policies, of Reaganism, basically, the death of the New Deal. And I thought it was interesting that of the 200 and some odd thousand people who showed up at the Democratic caucuses, a significant proportion, they're still counting the numbers, but a significant number of them were independents and even Republicans.
And younger people.
Yeah, and I don't go along with the notion that the Republicans who showed up to caucus with the Democrats were there to try to get the least electable guy on. I think that the Republicans who have said the hell with the the Republican Party.
What the polling shows is that more and more independents ideologically are moving in a progressive direction than in a conservative direction. So I think if you look at that, the excitement, the fact that independents came out, the fact that young people came out, I think that that is just a very good omen for the rest of this year. We just got to keep up the effort, and so I was excited by that.
Yeah, it's a huge story, and the fact that if the conventional wisdom is, you know, if there's anything to it, that Hillary Clinton represents kind of the machine, and John Edwards and Barack Obama represent rage against the machine or change.
Right.
More than two-thirds of the people who showed up said, we don't want the machine anymore, thank you very much.
That's right. And I just held a press conference in Burlington, Vermont yesterday to talk about an issue. I want to say a few words about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, I think, that people are so desperate for fundamental change in the direction of this country. And I think if you look at the Bush record in, you know, whether it is Iraq, whether it's environmental policy, whether it's tax policy, the deficit, whatever it may be, is a disaster. But one area that we haven't focused probably enough attention to, which I think came out in Iowa, John Edwards did a good job in raising that issue, I think, is what's going on in the economy.
Yeah.
I talked about in Vermont, but it's going on all over America, is a level of desperation among lower-income people that we have not seen in this country for many, many years. And what we're talking about is we have a cold winter right now. It's cold in Vermont. It's cold all over the northern part of this country. You have elderly people trying to come up with over $3 for a gallon of home heating oil. Many of them can't do it. And as a result of the increase in home heating oil, the federal LIHEAP program, low-income heating assistance program, those dollars are not going anywhere near as far as they used to be. Fewer people on the program now, or people getting less money. But you're seeing now the danger of people in the United States of America going cold. You're seeing throughout this country emergency food shelves running out of food. And the story there is that working families are now coming in and saying, we need additional help to feed our family despite working 40 hours a week because everything is going up and we just don't have enough money to feed the kids. So you're seeing hunger growing in America. You're seeing in homeless shelters in Vermont and, again, all over this country, more and more people coming into homeless shelters. They're running out of beds because people can't find affordable housing. So you add that all up, and you're seeing among a sector of our society almost third-world living conditions. You're seeing hunger. You're seeing homelessness. You're seeing people going, beginning to go cold. And this is the United States of America, while at the same time, the wealthiest people in America have never had it so good. So these are, I think, the reasons that many people are saying we can't continue this neoconservative economic policy, tax breaks for billionaires, more and more on the military, more and more for Iraq, and yet the needs of the American people are largely ignored.
Right, and blowing out the dollar. This is something that really concerns me. When they stopped publishing M3, I think it is the rate at which they're pumping money into the economy. There's an op-ed or an opinion. The main editorial in today's Wall Street Journal. If I may just share two sentences from it with you, they said the price of gold has risen 239% since 2001, and the price of oil has risen 267%. That means if the dollar had remained as good as gold since 2001, oil today would be selling at $30 a barrel. In other words, oil is going up, gold is going up, but what this really means is that the dollar is going down, that these insane policies of borrow, 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 and then spend it on a war someplace else where the money doesn't even come back to America or gets made into things that get blown up, that these insane policies of the Bush administration are destroying our currency.
That's right. No, that's true. And it's not just our country. We're seeing it in the fabric of our lives. And it's not just lower-income people. It is millions of good-paying manufacturing jobs that have been lost. It's more and more people who can't afford health insurance. It's the reality that if you're a working mom, it's very difficult for you to find affordable child care.
This is like the ultimate hidden tax. You know, debasing the currency is the ultimate way to tax people without them realizing that they're being taxed. Instead, they're paying more for gas or for oil, and they think that the price of oil and gas is going up. What's happening is the value of the dollar is going down.
No, that's a very important point. And I think what we need to do here in the Congress is to make it very clear to the American people which side we are on, and be prepared in a way that we have not seen for a number of years on taking on these big money people, whether it is the banking industry, whether it's the insurance companies, whether it's the drug companies, whether it's the financial broad credit card people and financial service people. I think the American people want Congress to start standing up to these people and restore America to the position not only that it was in the world, but protect the middle class here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's that wave of populism that is sweeping America that we saw yesterday in the caucuses.
No, I think that is correct. I think we're seeing now language that has not been heard in political dialogue in a very long time. I mean, especially from John Edwards and others, identifying the reality that if we are going to be successful in turning this country around, we have got to take on the big money interest who have so much influence in our economy and in our political life and in the media as well. It is just amazing to me how far out of step the media is, in fact, with the reality facing ordinary people. You keep reading editorials in defense of this disastrous trade policy, whether it's the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, certainly, Washington Post, telling us how great this unfettered free trade policy is. And you go down to Main Street all over America, and people are saying, wait a minute, I'm losing my job. My wages are going down. I'm losing my health care. And the richest people are becoming richer. These trade policies are not working for me.
Yeah, that was that laid-off Maytag guy that John Edwards was using in his closing day commercial yesterday, the day before.
Yeah.
You know, saying, you know, where did my job go? You know, it's gone. It's gone. And I want somebody who will fight for me. And you know, I believe that Barack Obama and John Edwards, and hopefully Hillary Clinton, I mean, there's still a very good chance she'll end up as the nominee. One of the three of them, all three of them, will adopt these more progressive and populist
views. Well, it's our job to make that happen.
Yeah, amen, amen. And it's going to take, and it's not your job, my job, it's the job of
all of us, all of our listeners
together. Yeah, we have to get active. We have to get out there and get active. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, 866-303-2270, right after the break. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Friday, our first hour every Friday. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, 866-303-2270. And Steve in Mountain View, California, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, Senator Sanders. I have a question. Is it true that President Bush actually performed an illegal pocket veto during the Christmas holiday? And if so, why would we bother talking about elections if Congress isn't going to uphold the law?
Performed a pocket. Oh, that was on.
Congress was still in session.
Yeah, he did.
He can't just
on a authorization bill. But you know, I think he has. Look, we in terms of Bush, what we have to understand is that we have a president who has been a disaster in almost every regard. He has chosen, in terms of spending bills this year, to either veto or threaten to veto legislation which is important to the American people because he thinks that Congress is spending too much money. But when the Republicans were in power and we had earmarks for several hundred million dollars for bridges to nowhere, we had huge expenditures on wasteful projects, he did not take out his veto pen at all. What he is doing is being extraordinarily partisan. He is trying to cut back on programs that the most desperate people in this country need, programs that the middle class needs in order to save up money for tax breaks for the wealthiest people and for the war. So
on this particular situation, the Senate was held in session over the holidays because that's where people are confirmed.
Yeah,
but the House actually went into recess, didn't it? And therefore, an appropriation coming out of the House could be pocket vetoed.
Well, he could veto it. I mean, that is his power. But what we stopped him from doing in the Senate is making recess appointments.
Right. But with regard to the appropriation that he decided that he was just not going to sign and therefore pocket veto, because the appropriations come out of the House, does that mean that was legal for him to do that? Or is this something we're all going to have to check with the lawyers
I
don't know the answer either. I had a couple people yesterday.
The president has the right to veto. He has the right to veto.
Yeah.
The question is what he vetoes, and he has been consistent in signing bills that give tax breaks to people who don't need it, that spend all kinds of money on the war, and he vetoes because we're spending too much money. I'll give you an example, just one concrete example. I worked very, very hard last session to expand funding substantially for community health centers, which provide health care on a sliding scale basis to people all over this country. Well, he thought we were spending too much money on that, and he wanted us to cut back on that before he would sign a bill. So if you're helping the middle class, if you're doing health care, doing education, he doesn't like it. If it's tax breaks and military spending, he's ready to sign. And right. That's the guy we have in the White House.
Yeah, that's the bottom line. Laura in British Columbia, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. It's an honor to speak to you. I lived in Vermont for a few years. My question has to do with the filibuster. I know when the Republicans were in power, unlike now when they seem to be in power anyway, they were threatening the nuclear option. Now, I realize that's not a good thing to put into the Senate rules because you do like to have an option for the minority to have its voice. However, has anyone considered instituting a rule where you would limit the number of filibusters that any one party could do in any session of Congress. That way you could bring it back to what it was intended for, which is rather extreme circumstances, rather than just trying to block everything that's being done by the party in power.
Well, Laura, you raise an interesting issue that some of us are thinking about, and I don't know the answer yet. What you do know is that last year the Republicans did more filibustering, 62, I believe, 62 filibusters, than had ever been done in a two-year session. Do you know that, Tom?
Yeah, it's amazing.
In one year, they did more than anybody.
You know, what's most amazing, Bernie, is I think most Americans don't have a clue about
that. That's right. So let me go through the how this thing happens and what happens. Is that many people think, my goodness, you need 51 votes to win in the Senate. Well, you don't. If an individual chooses to get up and say, well, wait a minute, I want to continue talking and talking and talking, which means I don't want a vote ever to take place, you have, under the rules of the Senate, you can do that. What the Republicans have done is on virtually every significant piece of legislation, that's what they have done. So the votes that people read about is not whether you're going to stop the war in Iraq. The vote is whether you're going to stop debate so that you can vote on whether to stop the war in Iraq. We have on our side 51. They have 49. And what they have chosen to do is, on every important issue, demand that we have to get 60 votes for a cloture to end the debate. And that is very, very difficult to do. For example, an issue that I have been working very hard on is global warming. And I think it is absolutely essential that we move towards sustainable energy, that to do that we need tax credits for both the wind industry and the solar industry. We only got 59 votes because they wanted to filibuster that. But we'll talk about that more in a moment.
Okay. All righty. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Bernie taking your calls at 1-866-303-2270. 27 minutes past the hour. Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Ours, if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. Also a blog over at airamerica.com. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, I see the dream. I see it coming. I saw it last night in Iowa. Oh, my. And welcome, by the way, to KMPT, our newest affiliate. We are live now in Missoula, Montana, AM 930. And so happy to be on the air there and so pleased to be there. And we are trying to organize a trip out there to drop in and say hi live and in person to the folks and to find folks in Missoula. So welcome. And our phone number for our new listeners, 866-303-2270. As he has for every Friday for about 5 years now, Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls. Bernie, did you want to wrap something up before
we go
to the calls?
Laura asked a good question, and I really didn't get around to answering it. The bottom line, it seems to me, is if the Republicans are going to filibuster, filibuster, and filibuster, what I think we have got to do is to say, you want a filibuster? Well, guess what? Filibuster. We're going to be here 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And you want to discuss the issue of why you want more tax breaks for the rich and why you want to cut programs in education and health care? Let's have that discussion, and we'll have it. At 3 o'clock in the morning on a Monday night, that's what you want, that's what we'll do. But you can't get away with this with impunity any longer.
Now, what's the most effective way for me and for each of our listeners to encourage that to happen? Should we be calling Senator Reid's office? Should we be calling our local senator, our two senators?
Absolutely. I think so. And to say that, look, we are sick, the more the American people understand what these guys are doing, I think the more anger there will be out there, the more energy there will be out there to bring about real changes in what goes on in Washington, get rid of a lot of these Republicans.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And the if you want a toll-free number to call the Capitol Hill, and it'll get you the Capitol Hill switchboard, and you simply tell them what state you're from. They'll tell you who your two senators are, or you can ask for Senator Reid's office. Go to callcongress.org, and we've got it links to a page on my website, and I've got a list of all the toll-free numbers that I've been able to find, as well as the main switchboard number, which is 202-225-3121.
And all of the, virtually all of the senators will have toll-free numbers in their home districts.
Which you can find on their websites.
Sure.
Pat in Granite Falls, Washington is on the line. Hey, Pat, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Senator Sanders. Now, this is my question. Is there anything that can be done about the health care? I'm 83. I worked most of my life. I have belonged to HMO, of course, and I pay $112. It's taken right out of my checking account each month, $112 a month. And then I called the other day to see if I, because I need new glasses. It's been about 5 years. You're allowed new glasses every 2 years under my HMO. And they said, oh, yes, and it will cost you $13 a month more now if you want to get on this new plan we have. Otherwise, you're just out of luck and you won't have as much coverage. I thought, oh, the poor things are going out of, running out of money, I guess. Anyway, the thing is, what can be done? You know, there's something wrong there.
Pat, there's not something wrong. There is an enormous amount wrong with our health care system. We have the inefficient and wasteful health care system of any major country on earth. We spend almost twice as much as any country for health care, and yet we have some 47 million Americans who are uninsured and even more that are underinsured. And the very simple answer is that Congress and a new White House have got to stand up to the insurance companies, stand up to the drug companies, and give us a national health care program which guarantees health care to every man, woman, and child as a right of citizenship. And we can do that without spending any more money than we're currently spending, because we're spending a heck of a lot of money on health care.
Yeah. Amen. 1-866-303-2270. Dan in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes. I just want to say that of all the discussion I has been lacking of the poor, there's no way that anyone can dig themselves out, get ahead. There's no offset. You know, in my case, I was injured on the job, so I bought the most modest home, and it goes nowhere. You know, fortunately, I have that over my head, and that's it. There's no offset for it, you know, whatsoever. Instead, it rips, you know, the Medicaid rips me off, you know, to where I'm just bottomed out to nothing.
Well, Dan, you know, what we are seeing in America today is a significant increase in poverty. Since Bush has been president, 5 million more people have joined the ranks of the poor. And people are really hurting very, very badly. And I have nothing magical to tell you other than the fact that we've got to change the direction of this country so that instead of having our government provide benefits to the very wealthy, we have to understand that there are millions of people who are really hurting in terms of health care. We just got a call a moment ago, in terms of child care, in terms of affordable housing, in terms of prescription drugs, and on it goes. If you look and we don't do this. You know, Tom, one of the things where, as a nation, we really lack is looking at what's going on in other parts of the world. You have countries in Scandinavia, whether it is Finland, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, gone a long way to wiping out poverty.
Yeah.
There is a safety net there that says that people are going to have at least a minimal standard of living, that all people have the right to go to college tuition-free, that all people have health care. People would fall off their chairs if they knew what kind of benefits were available in many European and Scandinavian countries when you have a baby, that you don't just get 3 months off without pay, but in many of these countries you get 6 months off with three-quarters pay, that if you have a baby you get a stipend, the child care is free. But in our country we have a runaway capitalism in which government seems to be bending over backwards for the needs of the wealthiest and most powerful, and we have forgotten about the middle class, we've forgotten about working families, we've certainly forgotten about low-income people. And that is what this election is all about. It's not only getting rid of Republicans, it's demanding that the next president of the United States have the courage to represent all of the people. There's going to be some really tough fights. If we get to a national health care program, let me tell you, the insurance companies are not going to go quietly into the sunset, nor will the drug companies, who charge us the highest prices in the world. We need the kind of efforts that we just saw in Iowa, where so many people were involved in the political process. We need to nationalize that effort, where millions of people say, wait a second, our health care system is not working. We can do much better. We can have a quality of education in this country for all of our people much better. But to do that requires a lot of political organizing and activities on the part of people.
Yep. Amen. Tony in Seattle, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, gentlemen. Let me thank you for letting me have the opportunity to engage you intellectually both here. Senator, are you not a populist?
Well, among other things, I conceive my job as representing people, yeah, ordinary people.
I know that the populists, just like the Democrats in the past, excuse me, have been, you know, they've dealt with, like, racism and stuff where, you know, they've been, like, anti, you know, what would now be, you know, considered, you know, they were racist in the past, just like the Democrats. Yeah, but my point being, you know, they had to be convinced that, you know, America wasn't ready for a black man. And, you know, I have to change my mind now. I am what America calls a black man because, you know, I'm mixed both black and white. But, excuse me, in other parts of the world, like Brazil, if you have any lighter color in you, you're considered a white person. So I just would like you to address some of your personal racism.
Well, Tony, is this sort of, are we ready for Obama? Is that the bottom line?
Well, we're ready.
Here?
Yeah.
Thank you, Tony.
Can you guys?
I'm sorry. Tony,
certainly, one of the positive developments out of Iowa yesterday, which is an almost all-white state, is that people look beyond race. And I would hope, and I believe, I mean, we have many problems in our country, but I would say the one area where we have made substantial gains in the last 30 or 40 years is in terms of race. And I think what is very good is that people are looking at Obama's positions on health care or the economy or trade rather than saying, oh, my God, he's a black guy. Can we elect a black guy? That's not the issue. It goes without saying that anybody in this country of any race, color, creed, has the right to hold public office. And what we have to focus on is what that individual stands for, what his or her record is. And of course, it's the same issue with gender. I hope that as a nation, we're way beyond where we're worrying about whether somebody is a woman or a man or whether they're gay or they're straight. We got to look at what these people stand for and what people can do.
Yeah, oh, amen. I guarantee if Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton are the nominee, you're going to see either the Harold Ford subtle racist type attacks, or you're going to see the Rush Limbaugh trotting out his old ad for the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox. I mean, they will use sexism and misogyny, and there is a small percentage of Americans who will go along with
but
it.
I think
we're the majority of us are way past that.
I don't think
it's going to work.
Look, there's no question. Does the racism exist?
I just don't think it's going to work.
Sexism exists? Of course it exists. Does Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama receive some of that? Absolutely. But I think you're right. And especially what is very exciting, it's a generational thing. Mm-hmm. I think among younger people, those issues are not significant. You still have pockets of racism and sexism, but I think as a nation we're moving largely beyond that. We're prepared to look at what somebody stands for.
Yeah, amen. And a fine thing it is. I mean, this is one of the reasons why last night was so historic. It was so extraordinarily historic. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. His website, sanders.senate.gov. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. The senator taking your phone calls at 866-303-2270. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman program, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, I'll be hanging out there during the break. Stick around.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman program.
Let me say thank you to those who love many. Let me say thank you to those who still fight fair. Out there.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line, taking your calls. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. His website, sanders.senate.gov. And Tom, in Elizabethton, Tennessee, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Mr. Hartman. I consider myself an independent conservative, but I do enjoy listening to your show. First off, I wanted to congratulate all your Democratic listeners on Mike Huckabee winning Iowa, because if he goes on to win New Hampshire, you guys can basically sit back, smoke cigars, and drink scotch until November. won't even be any point in campaigning.
I don't know. Right. I think Huckabee could be formidable, but we'll see. We'll see.
I don't.
Your question for Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, I was wondering, why do you think, personally, that people in Washington are so attached to the party system? Now, I can understand why people would think they have to run for one party or the other to get the support necessary to get into the federal government, but why do they feel so called to stay with the parties once they get there, even when those parties no longer represent their core beliefs?
Well, it's a good question, Tom. As you know, I run as an independent and was elected to the Senate as an independent while I caucus with the Democrats here in Washington. I think that parties, to be honest with you, having said that, I think parties sometimes get a bad rap in the sense that in America today, the parties do not represent, in my view, effectively the American people. I think what you have with the Republicans is a right-wing extremist party, mostly controlled by the big money interests in this country. I think in the Democratic Party, you have a centrist party, also largely influenced by big money, which leaves a huge gap for working families and the middle class and lower income people not having the kind of representation they need. But ideally, what a party simply is about, which is a proper idea, is people coming together with a common ideology. The fact that we have weak parties in America in the sense that they're dominated by big money does not make the idea of a party a bad idea. And I think what the remedy is for ordinary people to get involved in the political process, to make the parties more responsive to the needs of average people rather than the big money interests, which have so much influence and so much lobbying power right here on Capitol Hill.
Okay. Bonnie in Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Bonnie, you're live with Senator Sanders.
Hello. Are there enough votes, Bernie, for the Media Ownership Act to be passed and to override a veto in Congress? Because, as I recall, when Powell tried to do what Martin is doing, now people from the left and the right got their backs up. So there seems to be support to go against Martin. And then my second question is, can the Dems start framing this issue in a way that reminds the FCC and the public that the FCC is a creation of Congress and it's not like an administrative cabinet position?
Very good question, Bonnie, and I don't know that I can give you a definitive, intelligent answer here. What Bonnie is referring to is a recent decision by the FCC and Chairman Kevin Martin, which would deregulate the media and allow companies in certain areas to own local television stations, radio stations, and newspapers, which I think, and I gather Bonnie thinks, is a very bad idea for a democracy where you're giving one person so much power over the media. There is, as Bonnie indicated, bipartisan opposition, including some conservative Republicans, who are very nervous about this kind of concentration of ownership in the media. I cannot tell you, Bonnie. I just don't know how much support we have to override this decision. Certainly Bush is sympathetic to it and to his friends in the big corporate media. It's an issue I'm going to play a very active role on, because when we look at the problems facing our country, one of them is that the American people are just not getting a whole lot of different perspectives out there, and that is because media is increasingly owned and controlled by a handful of large media conglomerates. And they're giving you a corporate point of view and not a point of view from the needs of middle class or working Americans. If you turn on television, you'll see so much unbelievably bad stuff when we have the opportunity to do so much good stuff out there. So it's an issue that I will be heavily involved in, but I just don't know what the what the votes look like.
Okay. Irving in Manhattan, New York, listening to WWRL. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello?
Hello, Irving. You're on the air.
Yes. There's a contradiction with some of the things that has been said for this reason. I'm confused. I agree with you that the vote yesterday did indicate that Edwards' message was really taken very seriously and important. Yet, why didn't Edwards become number one? He was way off on the voting where Barack, you know, became number one. Not that I'm against Barack. I'll vote for him no matter what Democratic wins. But why wasn't it Edwards that...
Well, you raised a good question, Irving. I don't know if anyone knows. There's a lot of dynamics that goes on, the money that's spent, the quality of organizing. I would say that the bottom line in yesterday's election is that Obama happens to be a very charismatic guy. I know he came to Burlington, Vermont for me during my election, and we were thousands and thousands of people came out. It just blew me away. He is very charismatic. He has excited a lot of young people. I mean, one of the stories of yesterday, which is very promising, is a lot of people who had not participated in the political process in Iowa came out, and a lot of them came out for Barack Obama. So I would say that's probably the answer, that Edwards, in fact, if you look at the size of the turnout, Edwards got a hell of a lot of votes, as did Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
But I think Obama touched the nerve among people who had not previously participated. That probably was the difference.
Yeah, there you go. A friend of mine, Nancy Skinner, ran against him in the primary for the Senate for the Democratic primary in Illinois. And she said, this guy's a rock star. And this was before anybody had heard of him. He's just amazing. So anyhow, Brunch with Bernie Hour, Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. Go over, check it out, sign up for his newsletter. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, good. Talk to you soon, Tom.
Okay, great. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, for your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity. Tom Hartman. The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's an interesting juxtaposition for you. When Rudy Giuliani was asked about his stunning loss in Iowa, and of course, Giuliani, Iowa was never part to this would be his talking point. I mean, to give him credit is probably the wrong word, but to acknowledge his strategy, let's say. He never really campaigned in Iowa. He wasn't expecting to come in all that well in Iowa, but he really, I mean, it was just, you know, the bottom of the pack. In any case, when he was asked about this, he said, and I quote, "None of this worries me. September 11th, there were times I was worried." You ask Rudy Giuliani, it's like, you know, Rudy, what do you think about the price of potatoes? Well, the price of potatoes isn't bad, but I remember it was a whole lot better on 9/11. I mean, no matter what, he is going to figure out some way to say, be afraid, 9/11, 9/11, scare you, all that kind of stuff. And on the other hand, I think that we have had at least two of the three Democratic candidates, leading Democratic candidates, Obama and Edwards, saying essentially what Franklin Roosevelt said about the Great Depression. Roosevelt was not speaking of Hitler. This was back in, as I recall, 1934. He was speaking about the Great Depression.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
There you go. And last night, Barack Obama, his acceptance speech or whatever. I mean, let's keep in mind, first of all, that here's how it actually broke out. Was Barack Obama ends up with, as I recall, 18 electoral votes. I had it written. Yeah, 18. He gets 18 delegates, excuse me, that will go to the Democratic convention and be able to vote for him. John Edwards got 17 delegates, and Hillary Clinton got 16 delegates. So all of them, really, you could argue, won this thing, these three. Chris Dodd and Joe Biden were arguably the losers in as much as they dropped out of the contest. They said, okay, we get it. You know, we're not gonna push this any farther. And I salute them for having the courage to do that and for having the integrity to do that, to say, you know, let's let this thing go forward with these candidates who are the clear front runners and let the American people sort it out. But Barack Obama has 18 delegates now, 17 delegates for John Edwards, 16 delegates for Hillary Clinton. I think to turn this into a horse race, this is the important thing to keep in mind. These are caucuses. This is a delegate accumulating process. This is not a winner-take-all, first-past-the-post election like our presidential election is. So there's not a winner and a loser. There are people accumulating chits, as it were, votes, or, well, delegates is actually what they're accumulating. And so in Iowa, there are 57 delegates total on the Democratic side, 40 on the Republican side. And of those 57, they were just divided up the way I just shared with you. And then next Tuesday, and I'll be there in New Hampshire for that. On Tuesday in New Hampshire, there will be 30 more delegates that will be apportioned among the candidates. And then on January 19th in South Carolina, there will be 33 more delegates up for grab. And then on January 26th, there'll be 58 more delegates. And then on Super Tuesday, February 5th, you have 60 in Alaska, or Alabama, excuse me, 18 in Alaska, 67 in Arizona, 67 in Arkansas, 441 in California, 71 in Colorado, 60 in Connecticut, 23 in Delaware, 103 in Georgia, 73 in Idaho, 185 in Illinois, 41 in Kansas, 121 in Massachusetts, 88 in Minnesota, 88 in Missouri, 177 in New Jersey, 281 in New York, 21 in North Dakota, 47 in Oklahoma, 85 in Tennessee, and 29 in Utah. And so, you know, eventually somebody's going to end up with the largest number of delegates. It may or may not be the person who won. It may or may not be Barack Obama. We'll see. Time will tell. It may or may not be John Edwards. It may or may not be Hillary Clinton. Odds are, though, as a consequence of what happened yesterday, it will be one of those three. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all shakes out. On the Republican side, I continue to predict that John McCain is going to end up the nominee. I may be real wrong on this, but I think that that's the only place the Republican Party has to go. I think that what's happening with Mike Huckabee is not unlike what happened with Pat Robertson back in, as I recall, 1980, that, you know, he had his day. They all kind of patted him on the head and said, okay, great, we have now, bowed our head to the Christian conservatives and made them feel like they're part of the big tent here, and now we're going to go on, you know, without them, thank you very much, or without their candidate. We'll see. On the other hand, the part of the story that is absolutely not being reported is the populist dimension of Mike Huckabee. And I, you know, I mentioned this on the program, and I'm not by any means, by any stretch of the imagination, a Huckabee supporter. But this is the thing that I find fascinating, is that the populist message of John Edwards is ignored by the mainstream media, by the corporate-owned media, the large corporate-owned, particularly the television media in the United States, and much of the newspaper media. It's completely ignored. And when it is referenced, it's referenced as being angry. To the extent that Barack Obama has been picking up some of Edwards' populism and had a fair dose of his own from day one, that, by and large, is being ignored. And Hillary Clinton even has some populist message, actually some really substantial populist messages, and they're being ignored. And Mike Huckabee. I remember the TV interview I saw with Mike Huckabee a couple of weeks ago where he was asked, I think it was one of the Sunday shows, maybe Face the Nation or Meet the Press, and he was asked about, you know, you're being attacked by the Republicans for raising taxes when you were governor of Alabama or Arkansas rather, and you know, isn't this a terrible thing, et cetera, et cetera? And he's just like, hey, you know, we paid our teachers more, and we got a better educational result. I raised our school systems from being terrible to being pretty good, and I'm proud of that. And I'm watching this going, whoa, this is a populist message. This is, you know, the official Republican position is, you know, going back to Reagan, is there shouldn't even be a federal Department of Education, and we shouldn't even have public schools. After all, they only benefit the middle class and the poor. Schools should be privatized. And Huckabee is not towing that corporate line. Huckabee is in addition to being a Baptist minister and a Christianist, and frankly, I'm not sure how much of a Christianist he is. He is certainly an evangelical, and he wears it on his sleeve. But, you know, I don't know the extent to which he's pushing for a theology, you know, a theocracy in the United States. But there is a good, strong populist message in that. And I find it fascinating that the Republican Party is going to fight back against that. They're going to push back against that populist message. And frankly, I think that there's a certain amount of populism in John McCain, and that's what's got the Republicans freaked out about him, too. But what are they going to do? I mean, here's Mitt Romney. He spent millions of dollars of his own money. He spent, as I recall, over $7 million, you know, massively outspent. Huckabee, who spent about $1.5 million. And, you know, just cleared the slate in terms of spending money in Iowa and tanks. I mean, Mitt Romney has been writing this whole thing on his own checkbook, which is another story that is not reported in the corporate press. Why? Because where is that money ending up? With the corporate press. They would love him to keep opening his checkbook, thank you very much. They're not going to criticize him for doing that. And so the big story, frankly, in my mind, and I think David Sirota nailed it in his piece today, that many of you are getting an email, it's in many newspapers around the country, is that there is a populist message that is growing in the Republican Party and has taken full bloom to a large extent in the Democratic Party. And it's that message that Bernie Sanders has been talking about on this program for the last 5 years. And that is that it's about the people. It's about creating a society, a we society, to use Michael Moore's terms. Michael Moore says, you know, in his book, in his movie Sicko, there's that one incredibly poignant moment when he turns to the camera and he says, ultimately, we have to ask ourselves the question, and I'm paraphrasing from memory here, I may not have this exactly right, but words to the effect of, ultimately, we have to ask ourselves the question, do we want this America? Do we want it to be? Do we want America to be a we society or a me society? And I would argue that the me society folks are the corporatists. And by and large, that's the Republican Party and a startlingly and tragically large chunk of the Democratic Party. And that's the me society folks. And the we society folks ultimately are referred to as populists. That's the we society folks. And the way to bring about a we society is not to elect the perfect candidate. It's for all of us to get active and involved and push candidates in that direction. Because that's the only way it has ever happened. That's the only way it's going to happen now. We'll take your calls right after this, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
Anything goes Friday. You get to pick the topics. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Val in Bandon, Oregon. Hey, Val, welcome to the program.
Hi. The reason I called, I'm curious if I've been looking around the Internet trying to find the original raw numbers of the first vote in Iowa. Before they, you know, drop those or don't reach the threshold 15%?
That would have happened at each individual caucus meeting.
Those numbers aren't kept then? So we don't know.
I don't believe so, no.
I'm curious about the fact that Kucinich asked his voters to pick Obama number two. So that's hopefully, you know, one would think that that's where perhaps Obama got a pretty good chunk of votes.
I think Richardson said the same thing as well.
To give it to Obama?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you had the actual numbers, the raw data of the first go-around, if the people selecting these candidates in first place were a lot closer than this 8% spread that Obama has over Edwards and Hillary.
Yeah. I don't know, Val, and I'm not sure that there is any way to know other than, you know, going out and polling all, however many it was, I think it was 88 or whatever,
this is nothing that's actually just published and then...
Not to the best of my knowledge. I mean, I may be wrong on that. I'm sure if I am, somebody will send me an email or call in and correct me. But,
that would be great.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything like that, and I've been, you know, scrubbing the web this morning and certainly last night. But your question is a good one. The whole process question, the how did this come about, is a fascinating one. I think the bottom line, and thank you very much for the call, Val. I think the bottom line is just, you know, Barack Obama did a great job. I mean, he did a great job of campaigning. He had a message that people wanted to hear. He got out there. He got out there very well. I mean, you had this record turnout, more than 200,000 people showing up. And here's this kind of sad quote from Andrea Mitchell. She was on TV last night, NBC. She said this. She's talking about the Hillary Clinton room. She says the room was until about 5 or 6 minutes ago completely empty. This is a manufactured celebration. It really felt more like a funeral as people started strolling in from upstairs where they had obviously been gathered. This is unlike anything I've ever seen, a completely empty, dirge-like event. That's kind of sad. Here's another interesting thing. The anti-Mormon push polls. The New Hampshire Attorney General has determined that anti-Mormon push polls employed earlier this fall were organized by the polling firm More Information, M-O-O-R-E, Information, Inc., More Information has not yet confirmed the sponsor of the poll, but the firm lists presidential candidate Ron Paul as one of its clients. He is the only presidential client listed on their website. That's interesting. So we'll see. But I thought it would. The other thing that I thought was interesting was the very, very large number of women who voted for Obama, more so than voted for Hillary Clinton. The number of independents and Republicans who turned out. And I really truly believe that the Republicans who turned out and obviously the independents for the Democratic caucus in Iowa were people who are saying, okay, that's it. I've had it. I'm no longer Republican. I'm leaving that behind. You know, much like some Democrats did with Reagan in the 1980 election. So we'll see. We'll see how it all shakes out. Let's see. Laurie in Littleton, Colorado. You wanted to disagree with me, Laura. Laurie, so you go to the front of the line. Okay. Go for
vehemently.
It.
I am so completely offended once again by the Democratic Party and by the candidates that we have running. I'm sitting here in Colorado, and I don't know why I bother to register to vote. I don't know why I bother to consider coming for a primary, because election after election, by the time it gets to me, I'm stuck with whoever Iowa and New Hampshire decided my candidates are. I mean, to even emphasize how just unfair this is, Michigan tried to have a voice primary. The Democrats said, no, we're not going to take your delegates if you do that. And all of the candidates were pressured to pull out. I mean, and then you stand there and you congratulate Biden and Dodd over pulling out because 200,000 people in Iowa who have nothing in common with me made their voice known so the 49 other states don't get a say. I mean, it's offensive. It is just unbelievably offensive.
Well, Laurie, I'm sorry you're offended. I would encourage you to get involved with your local Democratic Party, run for political office, become part of the process and part of the, you know, as far as Biden and Dodd, it was obvious to them based on what happened in Iowa, not because Iowa is some unique little universe, but because it's micro to the macro, that they weren't getting the traction there that they hoped that they would get. Therefore, they're not going to get the traction anywhere else. It wasn't like Iowa decided it. It was that Iowa was the early indicator of it.
Because Iowa insists on being first year after year, and New Hampshire has to be first year after year. There's no rotating process. There's no everybody gets to vote at once. And
yeah, so I agree. That system is very, very badly broken and needs to be fixed. I absolutely agree with you.
But for you to say it's a good thing that they pulled out, I'm offended by that because these 200,000 people, it's spit in the ocean. Compared to the number of people, I mean, there's all kinds of people in Colorado that love Biden, and in Illinois and other places. But we base our opinion on these two little states that have to go first, and the rest of us, never mind, we don't care what you think.
And Joe Biden and Chris Dodd were doing the math. They were looking at the situation and saying, okay, if it's going down this way in Iowa, it's going to go down this way in Colorado, it's going to go. So they didn't, and therefore they're not going to get the money, they're not going to get the support to go any further. And
I think it
takes a lot of political courage. I think it takes a lot of political courage, frankly, to stand up and say, okay, I get it. I'm gonna move on and support and get behind the candidates who are moving forward. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
34 minutes past the hour here on Anything Goes Friday. Let me just lay out, I've said this many times in this program, but it probably deserves a mention, one more mention, with regard to the primary process. Our last caller saying, you know, what a tragedy it is, essentially, that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 states, something like that, on a very early basis, get to winnow the field. And broadly speaking, I don't disagree with that sentiment. And in fact, here is my suggestion to cure this. From the founding of this country, or from about 15 years after the founding of this country, or 10 years after, when the first political parties first emerged, the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans, now known as the Democratic Party, until the 1970s, up until about 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the parties themselves got together and the activists in the parties decided who would be the nominees for president. Now, at many times in our history, the parties had been so completely taken over by big moneyed interests, particularly during the Gilded Age and during the years leading up to the Republican Great Depression, that, you know, the average person had very little say and virtually no representation. But I think as a consequence of the Internet and broad communication, talk radio, things like that, that it's much, that the system is much more transparent, much more open now than it was then. And so my suggestion is do away with the primaries, because what the primaries do is they cause the people who spend the most money to end up getting elected. Well, not always, actually. In the Republican primary here demonstrated this. Mike Huckabee spent a little less than $2 million. Mitt Romney spent over $7 million, as I recall, and Romney lost. But by and large, it becomes a money primary. Who's got the most money? Who raised the most money? All that kind of thing. Who can spend the most money on carpet bombing the state or the country with television ads? So let's just go back to the smoke-filled rooms. Let's go back to saying the party activists are the ones who are going to get together once a year at the convention. They're going to do it on a state-by-state basis, and then they're going to do it at the conventions. They have state conventions and national conventions, and they're going to decide who the nominee is going to be. And those of you old enough to remember, you're going to have, you know, the individual state delegations saying, standing up and saying, you know, the great state of Michigan says, you know, we 16 votes for so-and-so and 22 for so and like that, delegates for so. And that's how it will be decided. And then that provides all the rest of us with an opportunity to become party activists, to get involved in the party and end up being those delegates. Now, it's an imperfect solution, but I think, frankly, it's better than what we have. We'll see. Virginia in California. Hey, Virginia.
Hi, my electricity just went out.
Uh-oh.
It's just you and me now.
Apparently your phone's still working, though.
Yeah, the storms. I was calling because I read an interesting article in the Progressive Populist. I think it was the November issue. That Barack Obama's success was going to be linked directly to if the youth vote could follow through, if they, you know, they're not flaky kids and they go off and party in Fort Lauderdale, and it was going to be critical that these kids show up. And I was just wondering what your opinion is about, I know I cried when I heard about Obama won in Iowa. To me, it's an incredibly important moment in American history. But is it a fluke? Is it just that these kids showed up? Because this article talked about how so much of his campaign is going to depend on the youth vote. Is this a fluke, or do you think he can carry this through?
I think he'll carry it. I'm not, whether he's going to be the nominee or not, frankly, I don't know. But I don't think that this is a fluke. I think that the young people are getting involved in the political process. Again, I mean, they have many times in the past. Bobby Kennedy was, you know, riding the waves of young people.
Oh, right.
To a large extent. You know, had he not been assassinated, I think that the youth vote would have really brought him out and was responsible for his popularity to a large extent. And frankly, there's something about Barack Obama, the charisma that Barack Obama has that reminds me of the charisma that Bobby Kennedy had. But, you know, I don't know. I don't think it's a fluke. I think he's going to continue. So, you know, let's hope.
I hope it's not a fluke, because it truly is. I hope America understands. There's something resilient about this country, that America's power is in its people. And
yep.
It's not in our government, and we can't let them divide us. They always want to divide us. They want to do the red and blue. They want to do the right wing. And that's where they get their power from, and we can never let them do that to us again. We have to be unified as a people.
Amen.
Well said, Virginia. Thank you so much.
Yep, you're welcome. Thank you so much. And the other thing to keep in mind is that we don't elect elect leaders in the United States. We elect representatives, which means that we have to be out there saying, this is how we want you to represent us. And the third thing to keep in mind is, this is not the end of the process. This is only the beginning of the process. This is just a small number of delegates who have been selected here. So, you know, there's still a long way to go in this process. And, you know, whether it's Hillary Clinton still has a very good chance of ending up the nominee. She has a huge machine and a lot of money. John Edwards still has a very good chance of ending up the nominee. He's got a massive union support all across the United States, a lot of people on the ground, strong organization. Barack Obama has a very good chance of ending up the nominee. He's got a lot of money, he's got a lot of support, and he's really caught the imagination of the American people. So at this point in time, I think for any of us to say, oh, yeah, this is what happened or this is who it's going to be, I mean, it's a big mistake. Matt in Napa, California, listening on Radio 960. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to talk to you a little bit about direct democracy. I think it kind of ties into what you're talking about. And one thing I wanted to object to a little bit that I've heard you refer to the mob rule, kind of, to me, that's a conservative talking point on direct
democracy. Hang on just a second. When did I refer to mob? I don't...
All right, I think on a couple of phone calls you've gotten, you've discussed that, you know, there are problems with direct democracy in terms of the initiative process and some other things. But,
oh, yeah. Well, I do have an objection to the initiative process as a pure process. I think, frankly, it should require a supermajority. There are two changes that I'd make to the initiative process, and here's why. Because the initiative process, this is where people can directly amend their constitution or pass laws. The reason why we elect legislators is so that they will have an opportunity to carefully read a law, that they will have people on their staff who understand the meaning of that law, that they will hold hearings, and that, you know, and the average citizen can't do any of that stuff. Okay. And yet the average citizen is being asked to play legislator with the initiative process.
Right.
And the result of that is that we get a lot of bad initiatives from Prop 13 in California, Prop 5, Prop 37, Measure 37 here. The solution is two things. Number one, to say for an initiative to pass, it doesn't take a majority, it takes a supermajority. It must have two-thirds of a vote two-thirds of the electorate rather than a simple majority. And number two, to say it is illegal for any organization or individual to put any money into gathering signatures for or promoting an initiative process.
Okay, I didn't really necessarily discuss the initiative process, more in the theory of direct democracy and whether it is truly the will of the people that is supposed to be represented by our representatives. And I think we are to a point with the Internet and stuff that we need to start taking a different look at how direct democracy can work these days. And, you know, I think there are some interesting aspects out there, and I'm not sure that you always recognize those. You know, in terms of, you know, I think we could use the Internet to make it really very clear to our representatives what the opinions of the constituency is, rather than just having them get phone calls all the time, you know, and there's no way for us as a group to get cumulative totals of those phone calls to really know, you know, what's being thought by the people.
Yeah. The problem that we've seen with that so far, though, Matt, is that a lot of elected representatives now have changed their websites so that you have to verify and validate that you actually live in their district before they will take feedback from you, because they have been so overwhelmed by email. There's a handful of people who send me anywhere from 5 to 50 emails a day, each individual. At a certain point, you just have to turn on your spam filter and say, sorry, you know, I don't have the bandwidth to read 500, 600, 800 messages, email messages a day, particularly when over 200 or 300 of them are coming from 10 people. And this is the same problem that elected officials are having. They're getting overwhelmed by a small number of people, and so they start to discount them. And the result of that or people have figured out how to use, you know, how to hack polls or how to use the web in ways that makes their, you know, so much that makes their power seem way out of proportion to what it is. Much like the right wingers were doing this with direct mail just 15, 20 years ago, where they would send out, you know, the NRA, for example, would send out postcards to all of their members and say, fill in this postcard and mail it into your elected representative. And all of a sudden Congress would get inundated with postcards, thinking that this was a grassroots movement when actually it was being orchestrated by the NRA. So, I mean, there is that problem with that dimension of direct democracy. I don't have an easy solution for it. I just, you know, that's there.
Yeah. Well, I agree it's going to take some work, and I think it would probably need to be a sort of a neutral source other than the the representative themselves that kind of had a way of gathering, you know, that they made some system available at least, though, that we could all.
I think the best thing, Matt, is Congress taking a break and the members of Congress going into their districts and holding town meetings. That's absolutely, in my opinion, the very best thing. And there's a lot of members of Congress who do that and do it very well. And there are other members of Congress who absolutely refuse to do that. And they should, their butt should be tossed out of office. They should be voted out. That should be the main thing that, in my opinion, that people use to judge whether or not anybody's a decent representative or not. Celeste in Rye, New York. We have about a minute before the break. Celeste, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, first of all, Leon Tolstoy's definition of a leader, the wave pushed ahead by the ship.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. You know, even on NPR this morning, I understood that John Edwards had lost. He's out of the race. How about that?
Well, that's nonsense. That's nonsense.
But my real point is that I think it's going to be Mitt Romney who is the ultimate candidate for the Republicans, because when I saw George Bush Sr. Take him out to, you know, introduce him
mm-hmm.
at that speech that he made, I said, oh, he wants Jeb Bush to be his vice president.
Right.
And I bet that's cut a deal.
And it may well be.
One way or another, he's going to make it happen, because they are criminal.
Yeah, and Mitt Romney is the corporatist guy. So, you may well be right, Celeste. I've been saying I think it's going to be John McCain, because I guess I've been saying that I think that there are still some Republicans who have some integrity, but that's a lousy bet. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Make the world change. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Strange stuff going on in the world out there. Maybe the guys who run the dollar are crazy. Yeah, like those guys at the Fed. Look at what they've done to the dollar. As I pointed out during the segment with Bernie, if gold was still where it was at, and oil was, if the dollar was still where it was at when George Bush came into office, oil would be $30 a barrel right now. And we've seen oil and gold both exploded about the same percentage, over 600%. Well, India has not failed to notice this. So now 120 interest sites. This is from the BBC. 120 sites of interest run by the Archaeological Survey of India, including the Taj Mahal, will no longer accept dollars for admission. Used to be $2.50, and now the dollar is worth so little, $2.54, the dollar is worth so little, it is now 2,500 rupees, which is now $6.35. So, good luck if you want to go to India and visit any of the sites. Lynn in Edison, or is it Lynette in Edison, New Jersey? Hey, Lynette, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I just want to start by saying that I was one of those who gave you a cheering standing ovation in 2003 after your speech on corporate personhood at the Unitarian Universalist Association General Assembly in Boston.
Thank you. That was a great meeting. Universalists, Unitarians are great, a great bunch of folks.
Yes, and I also was so happy years later to find you again on Air America. So, two things. First of all, when a caller on your show earlier today asked you and Senator Sanders why you thought Barack won in Iowa, both of you seemed to attribute it to most of it. What you said was that it was his charisma and his rock star status. And not mentioned at all was the fact that last night as I was watching the returns on the little script underneath the returns, it said that Barack Obama had spent, and his corporate buddies had spent, $9 million in TV ads in Iowa. Hillary had spent $7 million, and Edwards, it was less than four.
Right, $3.6 million for Edwards, yeah.
And so, interestingly, as you say, the corporate media neglected to mention that fact as possible influence on the
other hand, Lynette, Barack Obama was an absolute unknown in Iowa. And John Edwards was well known in Iowa. He you know, came in second 4 years ago and ran for vice president. So you could argue, and Hillary Clinton was well known in Iowa. She was well known all over the United States. She was first lady for all these years, and she's got all this PR. So it could be argued in Obama's defense that $7 million that he spent, or $9 million that he spent on television advertising in Iowa, still arguably wouldn't have given him the name recognition in that state that John Edwards being there for 4 years did, and longer, or that Hillary Clinton being first lady did.
Well, now, of course, I'm not denying that he is a charismatic figure. That's certainly true. There's another point I wanted to make, if I could.
Sure. Can I just add something, though, to what you just said before you go on?
Certainly.
93% of the decisions that we made, I read about this in my book, Cracking the Code, and there's some really good psychological research on this that the people in advertising and marketing know well. 93% of the decisions that we make politically as a people in the United States, and this is probably not so much people like you and me who are political junkies, but the average American makes, are made based on feelings rather than information.
Yes.
And that was the point that Nancy was making to me back, you know, 5-6 years, whenever it was, that she was running against Barack Obama in the primary in Illinois, was, you know, this guy gets in front of a crowd and he electrifies them. That has nothing to do with his issues. It has to do with that gut feeling thing. Frankly, George Bush is very good at communicating feelings. George W. Bush, you know, it may be a horrible feeling to you and me, but it's a good feeling to his followers.
Yeah,
I think we have to acknowledge that.
I have your book, and I taught psychology for 20 years, so I do have some awareness of some of those things. But money does speak.
Yep.
Let's never forget that. The other point I wanted to make, yesterday I became aware of a website called blackagendareport.com, and a man by the name of Glenn Ford has written a huge background. He and someone else, I'm sorry, I don't remember the other gentleman's name, have done a history on Barack Obama, and let me tell you what he has found is two things that struck me. First of all, his strong leanings toward pro-corporate ideas as far as government is concerned, and he was a member of the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, and then when these people confronted him with that, since that's so corporate connected, he denied the fact. He said, I don't know how my name got on that list.
But see, I believe John Edwards was a member of the DLC also.
Well,
and certainly, I mean, he was running with DLC positions, you know, when he ran for the Senate. People can change.
He denied it. Then later he's back on it. So I encourage people to go to that website. There's a 40-page, I'm copying it, article, Obama speaks, quote, "Oh, great white masters, you have just been asked to help America," unquote.
Here's the thing. Anybody who gets out in front, everybody takes aim at them. And
these are black people. I heard this on WBAI.
That doesn't mean that they're more or less credible than white people.
No, I understand that, but I've never heard such a... Well, if you read it, Tom, you will see that he quotes him directly over and over and over.
Yeah. I've seen the hit pieces on Hillary Clinton. I've seen the hit pieces on John Edwards. I've seen hit pieces on Barack Obama. I've seen hit pieces yesterday. Somebody sent me a hit piece on Dennis Kucinich, of all people. I mean, you know, they're out there. There is no such thing as a perfect candidate. What we have to do is get sufficiently active that whoever the candidate is or whoever the nominee is, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but I appreciate the call. Whoever the nominee is, that we can continue to push that nominee in a more progressive direction so that they are taking the positions that actually will return America to Americans and reduce corporate power in this country, because that's the stranglehold, that's the fist, the iron fist that is around the throat of this nation that has to be broken. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're going to get back to your calls and our ongoing conversation about the consequences and significance of what happened in Iowa last night. And, of course, Monday and Tuesday of next week, I'll be doing the show live from New Hampshire, from Radio Row, organized by Talkers Magazine. And And the Talk Radio News, the folks who are regulars on our show, providing us with a little news insight. But I wanted to get, for some time now, I've been wanting to get into this issue of the Writers Guild strike. And Patrick Verone is on the line with us. He is the president of the Writers Guild of America, WGA.org, their website. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
I was out in L.A. 2-3 weeks ago. I was doing my show from K-Talk, our affiliate in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And just down the street from Clear Channel's offices, a whole bunch of you guys were out there on strike, and we drove by and gave you the thumbs up, and you know, a lot of people were honking and whatnot. Give us a summary of the issues that are involved here.
Sure. What we're talking about is simple. It's the future. You know, for about 50 years now, the Writers Guild and also the Screen Actors Guild that represents actors and the Directors Guild that represent directors have bargained with the studios and with the television networks to get a minimum basic agreement for the talent in Hollywood. And over the course of time, we've covered television, we've covered both broadcast and cable. We have deals in home video for what used to be VHS and what's now DVD. And now we're at the stage where a lot of broadcast television and cable TV is moving to the Internet. That's also true for feature films, which we traditionally cover in our contract. And as it moves to the Internet, it's a brave new world of both how people are paid for new content and how people are paid when that content is reused. And so the negotiations that actually started in July but didn't really get serious until November when we went on strike have been about chiefly new media and payment of the talent for original content in new media and for reuse of the library, so to speak, of TV and films when they're downloaded or when they're streamed in new media. That's what it's about.
Right. This is the equivalent of if I write a book, and I have 20 books in print. If I write a book, I get royalties for that book. If it's turned into an audio book, I get royalties for the audio book. If somebody decides, if Amazon puts it on Kindle or whatever their service is, actually they've done that with one of my books that Random House published, What Would Jefferson Do? You know, I get a royalty for that. And so it's just, you know, as writers' stuff is moving to the web, I'm certainly getting royalties for my things.
Mm-hmm.
You're just saying if the movie that I wrote or you wrote or somebody, or the comedy piece that you wrote or whatever, if that makes it onto the web and somebody figures out a way to monetize that and they're making money off it, that some portion of that should accrue back to you.
Exactly right.
Yeah, and now you guys have worked out an agreement with David Letterman's production company, Worldwide Pants, and my understanding is that he has basically, or his company has said, cool, we'll just go along with everything you guys want. It's entirely reasonable, done deal. Is that a good summary?
I don't think the word cool actually came up in the negotiations, but but it's a fair summary. We bargain historically with there's basically 7 conglomerates that control media in this country and some in the world right now. And they bargained together in an alliance. And we banged our heads against the table for about 6 weeks in talking to them. They refused to make a deal. They actually walked away from the bargaining table on December 7th and have refused to come back despite the fact that TV is off the air for the most part and feature films are not in production, but they walked away from the table. So we said, okay, we'll negotiate, we'll bargain with any of the few but important independent companies that still produce media. And David Letterman's aptly titled Worldwide Pants came forward. And we negotiated
and said we'll do that. Now, so that's sort of the exception because Letterman apparently owns his own show, or at least Worldwide Pants owns his show. The Jay Leno show, though, is I believe, owned by the network, isn't it?
That's correct. Well, they're owned by NBC, NBC Productions, the same way that Conan O'Brien's show is owned by NBC. Back in the days when I was a late night writer, I worked for The Tonight Show when Johnny Carson was there, and Carson himself owned the show, and in those days he was able to make the same kind of independent agreement that Letterman made. By the way, Letterman made it on behalf of not only his show but also the Craig Ferguson show The Late Late Show that follows on CBS.
Mm, interesting. So Jay Leno is writing his own monologues, and you guys have informed him that that's a violation of his own membership in the Writers Guild. What's going to come out of that?
Well, Jay is a longtime member of the Guild, and we've had several conversations with him now, and it's clear to us that his writing is a violation of the strike rules. NBC and their lawyers are trying to sort of obfuscate the situation by claiming that there's an exception for performers, but we disagree, and there are strike rules, and so we're going to have to enforce them against Jay. But, you know,
so
Jay
picketing.
Was very supportive. I mean, he was on the front page of the LA Times. His writing staff is out there picketing still. I mean, he's in a difficult situation, and we're trying to make the rules, and I think we have made the rules very, very clear to him.
Right. We're talking with Patrick Veronese, the president of the Writers Guild of America, WGA.org, the website. Patrick, the three unions that you described, the Writers Guild, the Directors Guild, and what was the other one?
The Screen Actors Guild, yeah. which, by the way, also bargains with AFTRA, which is the television and radio artists.
Right, which I'm a member of, the American Federation of Television and Radio Actors, or performers.
Artists.
These are all basically what are sometimes referred to as above the line unions or above the line people. In other words, people who get ongoing royalties. There are also people who are members of unions who are below the line. If somebody is running the camera on a movie and that movie goes into DVD, they don't get an additional percentage of the royalties, although the author may, the author of the screenplay may, the producer may, the director may, and the actors may.
Well,
to what extent is my characterization of that above and below the line accurate, and to what extent are those below, if it is, to what extent are the below the line unions and actors, or members, coming into conflict eventually with you as time goes on, because they're really getting whacked. I mean, a lot of these folks are not making a whole lot of money, and we have about 2 minutes here left.
Okay, so I'll try to do this as quickly as possible. The above the line, literally the line itself, includes people who are impacted by this strike and by the fact that their production is shut down and they're not working. They tend to be members of unions like IATSE and the Teamsters, NABET. And although they don't get residuals in the same way that writers and actors and directors do, there is an amount of money paid into their pension and health fund, which I think contributes almost 60% to that fund. So when we're
talking, which reflects the assumption of residuals.
That's right. That's right. And so, but when we're talking about new media, and we're talking not only about residuals, we're talking about initial payment and simple jurisdiction for these unions, because otherwise, new content for new media is essential here.
So, in other words, right now, if a show debuts on the internet, you guys are out on the cold.
If we don't have coverage there, then nobody above or below the line is going to get the proper initial wages, the pension and health contribution, the residuals, all of that, credits. All of that is up in the air if we don't get that jurisdiction.
Right. How can individuals, I mean, there's a lot of us out here are just, hey, what happened to my show? How can people support the Writers Guild?
Well, there's several ways, and I think the simplest ways perhaps are to send an email to some of the CEOs of the conglomerates. There's a website called unitedhollywood.com that's been sponsoring several, not only fundraisers, but other interesting send pencils to the moguls kind of campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
I think more than anything, the viewership and the fan base, it just needs to be educated and informed of the fact that, we're ready to bargain. We've been ready to bargain. NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, Sony, the list doesn't go on much longer, but Disney goes on, and they walked away from the table. And
yeah, maybe the other thing we should be doing is voting for politicians who are willing to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act once more and break up some of these huge monopolies.
Well, sometimes it does feel like Teddy Roosevelt and the trust busting of 100 years ago, but
is needed.
But right now, what we're looking for is a contract, and we're hoping we can get more deals like we did with David Letterman.
There you go. You get more information over at WGA.org, the Writers Guild. Patrick Verone, the president of the Writers Guild. Patrick, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thanks, Tom. My pleasure.
Good talking with you, and good luck. 16 minutes past the hour.
listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to probably one of the most union-friendly programs in the world. I have three brothers. Two of them are shop stewards. One of them is engaged, is heading up negotiations right now in Lansing, Michigan, the printers union. The other is in the electricians union. Anyhow, the Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. I saw this for 40 years. My dad worked in a union shop, and we always had good health coverage. He had a pension when he died, when he retired, right up till the day he died. My mother's still getting some of that. Anyhow, by the way, just a heads up, we have a brand new comment line for the for you conservatives out there who are afraid to call the program or who just want to, you know, get something off your chest. Feel free. And, you know, anybody else, you're welcome to call our comment line, whether you agree, disagree, want to sound off, want to tell me where to go or to put it. Give the comment line a call, 202-536-5306. And you can find that over at, if you go to TomHartman.com and click Contacts up at the top, it's right up at the top of that page. 202-536-5306 to sound off on the issues of the day. Just please keep it under 30 seconds and know that your comment may make it on the air. 1-866-303-2270 are on the air number. And Dave in Los Angeles on the line, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to correct you on a small point that you made this morning about economic populism not making it onto the media.
Okay.
You're just watching the wrong channel. You should see CNBC this morning. They are running this, and they are scared to death. You can see it in the markets today. They allude to the fact of the job number. Folks, that's not it. The job number usually would make it easier for the Fed to lower interest rates and raise the market.
Right.
They had Huckabee.
By the job number, what you're talking about is the fact that it was just released today that there were fewer jobs created, that unemployment essentially is going up. Typically, unemployment going up raises the stock market because, number one, it means that labor is going to be cheaper, so corporations are going to be more profitable. And number two, if it's going to get bad enough that it starts to bite politically, the Fed will lower interest rates, which makes money even cheaper for corporations, which makes them even more profitable. But instead, the markets are down 231 points right now.
Absolutely correct. And they had Huckabee on this morning, an interview from this morning with Huckabee, and he was out there saying, look, I'm out to do the right thing. I'm out to do the Christian thing. And if you want to call that economic populism, go right ahead.
Holy cow.
So now the markets are looking at an aspect of, if it's a Democrat, it most likely will be an economic populist. And they're looking at their own party going, oh, my God, if Huckabee pulls this off, it could be an economic populist.
Yeah, so that's the thing. If Huckabee really is an economic populist, and I've been getting that sense for some time watching him, you know, setting aside his theocratic impulses, which frankly concern me tremendously, and the fact that a Republican appointing the next two or three members of the Supreme Court is a damn scary proposition. But setting all that aside, which is impossible to set aside, obviously, but nonetheless, if he is an economic populist, I would suggest to you that the Republican Party is going to do everything they can to get rid of him as fast as they can. And they're either going to find, you know, a dead hooker in the backseat of his car or a young boy in the bed in his hotel room, as the old joke goes. I mean, they're going to figure out some way to take this guy down.
Absolutely. Fox is very confused. They were confused last night when the returns came in, because of the same issue, and I think
Well, and to some extent, Ron Paul is an economic populist as well, and he's totally got Fox baffled. I mean, he's won every single one of their polls, and they're just totally freaked about that. Dave, thanks for the heads up on that. I appreciate that. Stuart in Seattle. Hey, Stuart.
Yes, 2 points. Thanks so much for clarifying that the Iowa caucus was not a winner take all election. That actually Obama, Edwards, and Hillary got almost the same number of delegates. I listened to the radio.
Yeah, Obama was the leader, not the winner.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's not a plurality rule system as the rest of our elections are. And I listened to the radio all morning to try to get those results, couldn't get them, and had a tough time finding out on the Internet, and finally did, and then heard you. Once again, the establishment corporate media has been trying to choose our candidates and our winners for us.
Yep.
Two, on Huckabee. You may not have caught this, but I was amazed to hear a Republican, a Huckabee, use the word plutocracy, a word that I wish every American knew. That is not a democracy, but ruled by the richest few, which is to a large degree what we have now. And he may be one Christian that understands that worshiping mammon, that is the worship of money, is a sin, and possibly like worshiping the devil or Pluto, the Greek god of the underworld.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting point, Stuart. Once again, another reason for the Republicans to be scared stiff of Mike Huckabee. Dan in Anaheim. Hey, Dan, I've got about a half a minute here before we got to take a break at the bottom of the hour. What's up?
Oh, okay. I just wanted to ask you your comment on the NSA spying. I never heard anybody talk about this, but, you know, at some point in time, it's going to lead them to financial institutions and business dealings.
Yep. That's one of the reasons why they're pushing back. They don't want to offend their corporate contributors.
Well,
and that's one of the reasons why when Chris
Dodd
filibustered the attempt to give these corporations amnesty, I brought him on the program the day after just to thank him up and down and congratulate him.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah, because, well, somebody's getting this insider information, and do we know who's getting that and what they're doing with that?
No, we don't. And the other question that we don't know the answer to what extent is the wiretapping that's going on being partisan? You know, Richard Nixon, if he had been wiretapped when he was wiretapping people, he was wiretapping Democrats. How do we know that the Republicans today aren't wiretapping Democrats? I think, frankly, they are. I'll put it right out there. I am astounded that no Democrat has gone on the floor of the Senate or House and asked that question, because I guarantee you, if the shoe were on the other foot, it certainly would have happened. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Thirty-four minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. As from the wire services, as they say, strange stuff here going on. The headline, Hillary repackages herself as a black man. In what some party insiders are calling a Hail Mary bid to win Tuesday's New Hampshire primary, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton today attempted to repackage herself as a black man. In the wake of her disappointing third-place finish in the Iowa caucuses, there was a consensus among Mrs. Clinton's campaign aides that her presidential bid needed to be rebooted. But few party professionals expected her to change her race and sex with only 5 days to go until New Hampshire. According to Clinton strategist Mark Penn, however, Mrs. Clinton's decision to become an African-American man was thoroughly consistent with her history as a change agent. He said Hillary's all about change, and changing her race and sex is just the most recent example of that. Speaking at a rally in Manchester, New Hampshire, Mrs. Clinton thanked her supporters for keeping it real and promoted her just-released biography, The Bodacity of Hope. She said, this election is about whether or not America is ready to elect a black man president of the United States. I firmly believe I am that black man. Meanwhile, former President Bill Clinton was dismissive of rival John Edwards' comparison of himself to Seabiscuit, remarking that in addition to being a black man, Hillary has for many years been a world-class horse. Ms. Clinton made her comments in an interview on PBS's Charlie Rose show, in which the former president, looking bleary-eyed and unshaven, touted Mrs. Clinton's victory in last year's Belmont Stakes. Yeah, no, it's a spoof. It's Andy Borowitz with permission. Thanks a lot, Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Chris in Michigan. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I've been listening to about the first hour of your show for 6 months on Sirius, and I wanted to let you know that I've decided to contact my congressmen and my senators on a regular basis.
Good on you.
My question for you, though, is this. I'm pretty sure my congressmen and senators are Republicans. What should I be saying to them in regards to stuff like the S-CHIP, Iraq, Social Security, and health care when they may fundamentally disagree with me based on what political party they're in?
You still need to let them know your positions. The Republicans can be responsive as well. I mean, there are some Republicans who are actually relatively progressive. Olympia Snow, out of Maine, for example. George Voinovich occasionally would take a progressive stand. Chuck Hagel, the Republican who used to be the president of the voting machine company that became ES&S, came out against the war in Iraq. He did that, in my opinion, because of feedback he was getting from his constituents. So I think that it's much harder to change a Republican's mind, particularly in a progressive direction. But that doesn't mean that you don't stop, number one. And number two, what you want to do is get involved with the local organizations like Democracy for America. They have these great activist weekend activist trainings. They have meetups in towns all over the United States every week or every month, depending on the size of the town. You know, democracyforamerica.com is their website. Join the local Democratic Party, join the local Green Party, and work to get that Republican kicked out of office next time around. That's my prescription, Chris.
All right. Well, I'm actually a truck driver, so although I'd love to be an activist in the weekend, I can't. But
well, in that case, find people who are and support their efforts.
All right.
You know,
thank you, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call, Chris. I mean, find your local. There, who are the people who are running against them and those Republicans, and do everything that you can to support them. Steve in Albany, New York. Hey, Steve, you don't like my smoke-filled room idea?
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I've been listening to your show for a little over a year and a half, almost every day of the week, and read several of your books this past year, including Screwed and the latest one, Cracking the Code. And I'm just amazed at what you said today, especially in response to the woman from Colorado who was very upset about Dodd and Biden dropping out of the race. And also then you made a comment that perhaps we should go back to the smoke-filled rooms where the activists of the party pick the candidates. And I think, you know, really, if anything, we need more democracy in this process, not less of it.
But here's the problem we have, Steve, and that is that until we have, see, frankly, I think that this is the only way that we might be able to get politicians who would take on the corporations. Until we have a corporate media, until the corporate media has been broken up, and not just the media, frankly, but this is the crux of the matter. Until this oligopoly, I mean, there's six or seven corporations that control about 90% of everything people in America hear, see, or read. And, yeah, I mean, there's like some 14,000 magazines, and more than 80% of them are owned by fewer than a dozen companies. Until somebody comes in and says, we're going to break that stuff up, you can't have democracy because the real messages don't get out there. There's only a small percentage of people. I mean, the number of people who are listening to progressive talk radio, the number of people who read The Nation magazine, the number of people who actually bother to get the story underneath the story rather than simply reading what they get in their local. I mean, our paper here, The Oregonian, is owned by a corporation in New York. I mean, you know, is a small percentage of people. And so I'm saying if there's only a small percentage of people in America who are bothering to politically inform themselves, then let's, at least for a while, try to put the political process back in the hands of the small number of people who are actually giving a damn about it, caring about it, and bothering to inform themselves.
I don't agree. I think that if you were to do that, you'd actually make it just a lot easier for people to be bought and sold politicians, which is why I think they kind of moved away from that in the first place.
Well, that was why they did it in the 70s. And you may be right. I mean, I may be wrong on this. I'm not. This isn't some absolute.
I would suggest that it's more that, you know, we need public financing of elections. And,
yep.
And if it was just required to get on the ballot, like because of what I've learned over the past year, I've got a lot more active this year. I would be very upset if my candidate, Dennis Kucinich, had dropped out last night. Because I don't even know what, like one of your other callers made a comment, he doesn't know what was the first round votes? What were those numbers? Those would be a lot more telling of where we are than knowing what the final counts were for Iowa.
None of us know. Hey, congratulations. I don't know if I used the word congratulations, but I said, you know, about Chris Dodd and Joe Biden, you know, good on you guys. That was, a poor choice of words, shall we say. I would never encourage anybody to drop out of the political process. The fact of the matter is that these two guys saw the handwriting on the wall and my take on it is, you know, from reading their concession speeches and things like that, is that they want the party to go forward unencumbered. They want the party to go forward and select somebody that, you know, where there's a broad consensus and move forward. I think that broadly speaking, that's a good thing. On the other hand, as I've said about from day one, about, for example, Dennis Kucinich's candidacy. Dennis stands for a whole bunch of positions, very, very progressive positions, that he has held for decades and is unwavering about and unyielding on. And frankly, I think his being in the race is one of the reasons that Howard Dean, having to debate him week after week, day after day, back 4 years ago, became more progressive over time. I think it's one of the reasons why several of the candidates, I think it's one of the reasons, frankly, why Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have become a little more progressive, although I think, frankly, John Edwards has had a large influence on them. It may well be that John Edwards became more progressive now than he was 4 years ago as a consequence of Dennis Kucinich. So there is a lot to be said for people who have a strong message and, you know, beyond just, hey, I'm part of the Democratic Party. And I don't mean to be painting Dodd and Biden with that brush, and particularly Chris Dodd, who is by and large a progressive. So yeah, I'll cop to it. I'll be taken to task on that. You're
okay,
right.
Well, and if I may, I have done a lot of work for Dennis Kucinich, and one of the things that was very interesting in trying to get him on the ballot here in New York was the number of Republicans I ran into while out on the street who tell me that if I was collecting signatures for Hillary and they could sign for her, they would. And we have closed primaries here in New York, so you can't sweat. You can't just go and vote for whoever you want to. But I found it very interesting on another Air America radio show with Bobby Kennedy. He's saying that you know Hillary does very well in the Republican counties of New York. That this is just baffling to me, and I think that you know the what Dennis has said. You know, he could win if people vote for him. Anybody could win if people just you know vote their heart.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I suspect though that your Republican people who were willing to sign the thing for Hillary were doing so because they think that she's the candidate that a Republican can beat. With regard to Hillary doing well in the districts of New York, she's done from everything I can tell. I mean, I live on the other side of the country. I live in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
But I have friends in New York, and from everything I can tell, she's done a very good job representing the state of New York. And just like Bernie Sanders has done a great job of representing Vermont, and Bernie is about as left as you can get, and in the Northeast Kingdom part of Vermont, which is about a third of the state geographically, it's the most rural and the poorest area of the state. You drive through the Northeast Kingdom, you know, everybody's got a pickup truck with a shotgun in the back, and everybody's got a George Bush sign out in front. Bush carried the Northeast Kingdom like 80% in the last two elections. Bernie carried it in the neighborhood of 80% also in the last two elections. So it's a matter of, you know, are you doing a good job for your district? Do you people know that you actually care about them and their issues? I think with local politics and with statewide politics, that frankly, it becomes a really important issue. I don't think those kind of things play as well on the national level until you get into the language of populism. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. I got to run along here. I appreciate it, though. And yeah, okay. I shouldn't have said it's good to drop out. You're right. You're absolutely right. I will cop to that. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room.
Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Chris Rosen, and Marcus Hillman, and Sean Kensing, Lauren Kirshner at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you so much. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Before I get back to your calls, just a Dave Lindorf wrote just an absolutely brilliant piece. You can find it over at buzzflash.com. And a tip of the hat to the folks in the chat room, one of whom shared it with me. This is Dave Lindorf's piece. In fact, it was Fred 42. The headline is Clinton's Embarrassing Iowa Flop Exposes Key Democratic Leadership Myth. And basically the point is that the DLC and the Clintons have been assuming that independent voters are, by and large, quote, conservative, that they're kind of war hawks, that they're like Republican lights, and that they're not all that bright, and that they, I mean, Lindorf is characterizing it that way. I'm not sure that the Clintons would. But the whole DLC idea is, you know, the average voter, the independent voters, they're kind of Republican light. And so the Clinton campaign was expecting the unaffiliated or independent voters and the Republicans who could show up at the Iowa caucuses to vote for Clinton. And instead they showed up and they voted for Barack Obama in large numbers and for John Edwards in significant numbers. And, you know, this is a shock to the Clinton campaign. Now, here's the problem. If this Iowa caucus is accurate, if it's micro to the macro, if it is a microcosm of the United States, if it demonstrates with some accuracy that independent voters want a progressive or populist running for president of the United States and will vote for one, many of the primaries that are coming up are closed primaries where only Democrats, only members of the Democratic Party will be allowed to vote. And independents will not have a say. And in those primaries, the machine is going to have tremendous power. And the machine, by and large, is controlled by the Clinton family. So this is Dave Lindor's take on it. And I think that there's something to be said for this. It's something certainly that we should be thinking about. If what happens, if the math that the Clintons are doing is that independents are going to go with Clinton because they really are Republican light and they really kind of like, you know, the war and they're really worried about Iran and they want a strong defense and they, you know, et cetera, et cetera. If they're going to do that, if the Clintons are assuming that, and if Hillary becomes the nominee as a consequence of closed primary states where the independents are locked out. But the reality is what we saw last night in Iowa, which is that the independents actually like somebody like Barack Obama or John Edwards, somebody who's putting forward a relatively populist message, then the Democratic Party is screwed in the next election, at least at the presidential level. I think it's a fascinating take and good food for thought. Along those lines, Bill in Scarsdale, New York, listening on WWRL, you had some thoughts on this.
Hi. A few minutes ago, you mentioned that Dennis Kucinich's presence in the race had made some of the other candidates a little more progressive.
In my opinion.
For a long time, I have been thinking that the only way the Democrats are going to get things in politics and this, you know, government back to the center is to do the same thing the Republicans do. They have to take extreme, you know, progressive views. They have to be to the left of center. What the Republicans do was they have really right-wing extreme ideas, which, you know, a lot of people don't accept, but it gradually moved everything over further to the right. So the Democrats, it's not enough for them to be centrist like, you know, like Clinton. They have to take views that are further to the left if they want to get anything back, you know, back to the center again.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Very well said. Thank you, Bill. Trish in Iowa City, Iowa. Hey, Trish.
Hi. Am I on the air?
You are.
Okay, thanks.
And thank you for calling.
I just wanted to respond a little bit to something a caller said earlier. I haven't heard this point yet made today. And she was very upset because Iowa gets to decide for everyone. And I, you know, live in Iowa, and I participated in the caucuses last night. Mm-hmm. And I guess just the point that I wanted to make is that, you know, Iowa is a small state, and candidates actually like Iowa to start because they can campaign face-to-face, and a campaign
retail
with
politics,
not very much money, actually can have a shot here in Iowa, where if they actually started out in a large state like California or Michigan or wherever, they may not have a chance at all. So the reason that, you know, that they even have a chance is, you know, I believe has to do with, you know, that they're campaigning in a small state and it doesn't take as much money. And I was disappointed, too, about Biden and Dodd dropping out. And I went uncommitted, tried to get Richardson to be viable, tried to organize the non-viable groups, and ended up in the Obama camp. But So that's all I really wanted to say.
I'm curious, Trish, you were there for the process and a participant in the process. What percentage of the Kucinich and arguably Dodd and Richardson, to the extent that they were the progressive candidates, what percentage of those folks ended up with Obama versus ended up with Hillary Clinton or with John Edwards?
Right. I don't have the numbers exactly. I know
what's
Richardson
your sense of it?
Had 18 and Biden had 12 in our precinct. And we had to have, a group had to have 38 to be viable.
Mm-hmm.
And there were like four Dodds and maybe four or five Kucinich. And so we all tried to get them all to band together and then just elect a delegate.
Mm-hmm.
But people didn't want to. And my sense of it, that most people ended up in either the Obama or the Edwards camp.
Hmm. Interesting. Trish, thanks so much. Thanks for listening and thanks for participating in our democratic process last night in Iowa.
Thank you.
Good on you. Good on you. Coming up next week, I'll be live in New Hampshire with the Radio Row Monday and Tuesday. Carl Bernstein's also going to be here dropping by on the elections. Mark Morano and I are going to be shaking it up on global warming. Gerald Celente on 2008 Trends. Former GOP operative Alan Raymond on how to rig an election. Confessions of a Republican operative. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you next Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.